Hello and welcome to this special edition of Mini Goes Wild, which is a repeat of a programme first broadcast on the 10th of May this year. Over 2 days at the beginning of March, University College Cork hosted the 8th Irish Ornithological Research Conference. Scientists, conservationists and bird lovers alike gathered on campus to hear the latest news, exchange views and forge new collaborations. Ornithologist Niall Hatch was on hand to capture the atmosphere of the bird conference.
Who's next up?
Is that Claire Herdman?
Perfect.
Yeah. And I actually have a poster on Chof. So
brilliant.
Is there a...
Perfect. Yep. I'll take you off here now. So and I'm going to just give you your name tag here.
Registration for the 8th Irish Ornithological Research Conference at University College, Cork.
And would you like a water bottle as well? We have some branded water bottles for today. Perfect. And
not just the plastic.
They're actually metal because UCC is trying to reduce our plastic waste.
There we go.
And what's the title on the poster?
It's the morning of Saturday, the 11th of March, 2023. Academics, researchers, conservationists and bird enthusiasts have come together to learn about the latest scientific research into birds, exchange views, form new collaborations, and even just to connect once more with old friends over chats about the birds visiting their back gardens. As you might expect, this conference is a very slick operation, the culmination of years of planning and countless hours of scrutinising scientific papers in order to select the most suitable and deserving presentations. The ultimate goal of the event is to give as complete an overview as possible of the ornithological research currently underway in Ireland, to showcase the cutting edge of Irish bird science, if you will.
Whoever's next.
Staging an event as ambitious as this is a major undertaking, one that would not be possible without a great team effort, one with volunteers at its heart.
I'm a PhD student, I'm part of the School of Bees, and I'm studying the effects of offshore wind farms on seabirds.
Volunteers like student Emma Murphy.
John is one of my colleagues, so he asked if we could come along and help out on the day. So.
Although the formal conference registration process took place on Saturday morning, proceedings actually began the night before in the magnificent Aula Maxima, or Great Hall, the symbolic and ceremonial heart of University College Cork ever since it first opened its doors to students in 1849. Situated in the north wing of the campus's ornate and stately main quadrangle, it played host to a much-anticipated keynote address by Pat Smitty on The Birds of County Cork, a landmark tome of which he is co-author.
This is mainly an overview of the birds of County Cork, their fortunes over the years and their current status and conservation.
Pat has had a lifelong interest in many aspects of Ireland's natural history, especially birds and mammals, with particular focus on the breeding biology and migration patterns of our feathered friends. An honorary research associate with UCC's Ornithology Group, he has published more than 100 scientific papers and notes, and in 2000 was conferred with an honorary Master of Science degree at the university.
The corncrake as a breeding bird, as a migrant breeder, is gone. The white-tailed eagle is back as a result of a reintroduction program. The little egret is a colonist, and here is a possible future colonist, the great white egret in the middle there. That's it, thank you.
At the end of his address, one of the audience members asked Pat how his interest in birds first developed. His brilliantly simple response stuck with me.
Thank you, Pat.
I walked to school and I observed things, he said. I walked to school. We all walked to school, or at least were transported there by some means or other during our formative years. But how many of us were paying attention to the natural world around us at the time? It's in childhood that our passions are formed and our lifelong values lay down their roots. Interest in wildlife is the default for most young children. If properly fostered, nurtured and encouraged, it will flourish.
A very rowdy bunch of bird watchers here. Okay, just one other critical piece of housekeeping, and that is timekeeping. Time is incredibly tight. We wanted to squeeze in as many people as possible today, so we have this very fancy piece of technology. When you're talking, the green light will be on. When it goes to orange, it means that you've got 2 minutes left.
in total, and that includes question time. And when it goes to red, that means you've got 30 seconds left to just get off the stage. Okay?
So presumably, most of you listening to this programme have never attended an ornithological conference before. So let's start with the basics. At its heart, this gathering is a forum in which scientists and conservationists can present details of their research into the endlessly fascinating world of birds, sharing their findings, fielding questions from their peers, and seeking both challenge and inspiration from the work and the reactions of others. It doesn't matter whether the subjects of your research are common or rare, or whether they are well known or understudied. The main criterion is that those presenting their methodologies or findings have interesting and illuminating tales to tell that further our understanding of the avian world.
We're really thrilled to have so many people here today. It's the 8th conference, and it was mentioned earlier, it was started in 1985. And the difference between this conference and perhaps others is that we've asked people to put their names forward to volunteer to be speakers, as opposed to being reached out and say, thou shalt speak and we'll all listen and we'll all venerate. And we have a few of those too. We have people that we have reached out to that we will venerate. But for the most part, the people that are presenting here today are people who wanted to speak and to share their story.
This year sees the highest ever number of attendees and presenters at the conference. So many, in fact, that the sessions have had to be moved to the Boole Lecture Theatre, the largest on the UCC campus.
You know, we heard Pat Smitty last night talking about species arriving and species disappearing. We can only see these patterns over long periods of time and sometimes over lifetimes. So to have us collectively looking at this is really important.
The theatre is named after George Boole, undoubtedly one of the preeminent figures in the entire history of the university. Boole was a renowned mathematician, philosopher and logician who spent most of his short career, he died in 1864 at the age of just 49, as the institution's first professor of mathematics. He is best known today as the founder of Boolean algebra, the system of logic which underpins modern computing systems. It's no exaggeration to say that George Boole laid the foundations for the information age. A worthy but challenging role model for any scientist, to say the least.
Today is also about building friendships and, most importantly, to enable future collaborations, because together we can do extraordinary things when we collect data.
The conference's opening address was given by the president of University College Cork, Professor John O'Halloran. It was John himself who first had the idea of organising an Irish ornithological conference back when he was a student at UCC.
When I was in the second year of my PhD studies in 1985, I decided it would be a really good idea to bring everybody together, both bird watchers, researchers in universities, and people across the country who had an interest in birds. And there were two objectives then. One was people to share their knowledge, and two, to create a directory of research in Ireland on ornithology, because we felt this was really important. And here we are, 8 sessions later, 38 years later, and at that time I was a PhD student, today I'm president, and I'm really proud to have it here at University College Cork.
Now in his role as president of the university, John's belief in the power and importance of people coming together is stronger than ever, driven by the knowledge that when we collaborate, we can produce something that is much greater than the sum of its parts. And, given his background as one of Ireland's most prominent ornithologists, he has an appropriately avian metaphor to illustrate it.
You know, the idea that we observe birds is fantastic, and I love them and I research them. But as a leader, I also use birds as a metaphor in the institution. So we recently launched our strategic plan for university for the next 5 years. And they said, make it unique to UCC. And I said, there's one way we can do this. Talk about birds. So I used a metaphor of murmurations. So we have lots of individuals in the university and they act individually. But when we act as one, in that beautiful murmuration, which we're all familiar with, where people can be leaders and followers, there's a real opportunity to do something special. But it is about helping us to understand the world outside and to secure the future for all, through understanding our birds, but also more importantly, understanding our habitats.
And like you're saying there with the murmurations, I think that's a perfect analogy, because the starling, of course, is the bird that does that. One starling on its own, it's a beautiful creature, but it's a bird like any other. But when they all come together,
absolutely,
they do something that's incredibly impressive. And it must be an opportunity then for lots of researchers who've been ploughing their own furrow, maybe, you know, isolated, to share that with their peers, to get feedback, to get responses. I'm sure that energy feeds other people that they're thinking, I could get a project out of this. I could work with this person. It must be really exciting.
But you're absolutely right, Niall, because in 1985, it was kind of eccentric to be a bird watcher, let's be honest. Richard Collins would regularly say that on this show, but also was different to do it in university and research. People often pursued really important topics as they saw then. But isn't it strange, 38 years later, there are more people doing research today on birds than there were then, in orders of magnitude in terms of the number of people, but also the distribution and the species that we're looking at. So we're getting a deep knowledge of our ecosystem, a deep knowledge of our species. It's got people who are collecting data, researchers who are sharing their knowledge, but also listening and learning, because we all know once you give a presentation, someone will ask a question, and suddenly a new opportunity opens for a pursuit of knowledge. So it's exciting. We're really looking forward to a whole range of presentations today.
I have had the great pleasure of attending many scientific conferences over the years, and my favourite aspect has always been the opportunity between sessions to chat to scientists about their research. Far from it being an imposition to have to talk shop during their breaks, as an outsider might assume, it's a rare ornithologist whose eyes don't light up when you show a genuine interest in their work.
My research was on the conservation genomics of red grouse. So the red grouse population in Ireland, it's quite small and endangered. But in Britain, they have a much larger population, and some of the populations are quite healthy. So people have suggested you could carry out translocations from Britain to Ireland. But this can have certain genetic consequences. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to look at the genetic consequences of what that might be.
The red grouse is an iconic game bird of the Irish uplands. Its entire life revolves around heather. It lives in it, it eats it, and it nests in it. Its beautiful russet plumage is the perfect camouflage for the habitat in which it lives. It's a bird much more likely to be heard than seen, with a call unlike any other. Listen carefully, and you'll hear it say, "Go back, go back, go back." Grace Walsh is a PhD student at University College Dublin. She has been conducting genetic studies into red grouse populations.
It was last year that I think a paper came out that suggested, and now it's been pretty much taken up, that red grouse on both islands are now classified as their own species. They're no longer a subspecies of the willow grouse. But regarding the Irish population, we certainly did find that they were differentiated from the British population, particularly in their immune response, their pigmentation, and also to food intake and energy control. But to actually classify them as their own subspecies within that, I think there would need to be a bit more work done. But they certainly are differentiated. And then that is what can have consequences if you were to introduce British birds. For example, just for the pigmentation, in Britain, grouse tend to live on these kind of managed heather moorlands that are very vibrant and they're very bright in colour. Whereas in Ireland, the habitat tends to have a higher concentration of grasses, so it's a bit duller. And as red grouse are prey species, they need to be able to camouflage into their environment. And if you're introducing then British birds that are adapted to that different environment, they're adapted to camouflage into that different environment, into the Irish population, they can breed and pass on their genes for, let's say, the wrong colour. And then that can affect, it's called outbreeding depression, and that can affect those populations in Ireland.
Speaking of this outbreeding depression and the genetic legacy of these British birds introduced from the island of Britain, are you seeing that they are leaving a genetic legacy? Are you finding traces of these in red grouse populations across the country?
So what we did, we had some museum samples, and they were from around 1880, and we found no legacy of British birds in those. For the Irish population, the contemporary Irish population, we did find a legacy. We found 30 to 40% of, it's called admixture, so of kind of mixing, in one bird that was on the Tipperary and Waterford border, so in the Knockmeal Downs, and another bird in Wicklow. So that does indicate that there has been some recent introductions. I couldn't really say when, but so there is that legacy there. Although there is also anecdotal evidence, and previous red grouse studies haven't found a legacy. And there's anecdotal evidence that the red grouse brought over from Britain don't do as well in Ireland.
You mentioned there that the evidence is pointing to the fact that the red grouse of Britain and Ireland is a unique species in its own right, as opposed to the willow grouse, which is found across much of the Northern Hemisphere. That famously, of course, turns white in winter. Our red grouse does not. Does that mean, therefore, that we should, I suppose, respect this species more? It's more important, the populations we have here, because this species, all of a sudden, it's much scarcer than we would have thought.
Yeah, definitely. And it's really important to define what the units for conservation are, and to try and preserve as much biodiversity, including the genetic aspect of that, as much as possible.
Most people's encounters with birds occur on land, be it a red grouse in the uplands, a friendly garden robin feeding on mealworms in the hand, or, increasingly in Ireland, a buzzard circling high in the sky.
Niall, I'm actually here presenting on seabirds. We've been doing a lot of seabird surveys in the Shannon Estuary, which amazingly has never been surveyed before. So it's really important, as industrial development is pushing in the estuary, to understand where the seabirds are, what species occurs, you know, where they're distributed, so that we can look at risk assessments. So that's what I'm presenting on.
Of the 10,000 or so bird species on planet Earth, it's the seabirds we know least about. Dr. Simon Barrow is best known to regular Mooney Goes Wild listeners, both as a passionate marine protection advocate and through his work with the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group and the Irish Basking Shark Group. I knew that Simon was at the conference to give a presentation on the distribution and abundance of seabirds in the Shannon Estuary, so here was my chance to find out more.
I'd say that's the reason they took my abstract, because I was one of the few people who were presenting on seabirds. So many gaps in our knowledge, and we so badly need that to have good, informed, proper management. At a time of unprecedented pressure, you think of all the offshore renewables, marine protected areas, marine special planning, and if you don't know where things are, how can you manage for them?
And of course, the state is obliged to know where those things are in order to make proper planning decisions and to safeguard our wildlife, because our waters are of international importance for so many species of birds and other marine life as well. Do you see more, I suppose, impetus from government to try to change this?
Well, you know what? The best and most effective way of getting this work done, filling the data gaps, is through the third levels and through PhDs. And I actually wrote to the department last summer saying, I've got a great idea for you. Why not fund 20 PhDs a year? That would cost in around $2 million, it's about 100 grand for a PhD. Spread them around the third levels and start filling data gaps. So feeding ecology of terns on the East Coast, habitat mapping in Galway Bay, all these things that we don't know about. And in year one, you'd get nothing. Year two, you get a bit of trickle information. Year three, you get a tsunami of information. Year four, bang, bang, bang. You'd get this, all the information to make effective management. And if you give money to third levels in Ireland, they're very, very good at leveraging more money out and building that capacity. And I got a very negative dis kind of reply back. So I think that lack of imagination, that lack of desire to fill those gaps is shocking. So we can just keep pushing. That's all we can do. Keep pushing.
I know that many of the presentations here at this conference are going to be about citizen science, getting ordinary people out there to submit their observations. Is there a role for that, you think, in the marine sphere as well? So it's harder for people to get out there, but still, can people be citizen scientists at sea?
There are, and there's some great ones. They tend to be coastal. There's like the Sea Track project, where people are monitoring birds along the coast. It is more difficult, you know, and it's a bigger challenge in terms of ID when you're at sea. Identifying seabirds, it can be quite tricky, as I know myself, and there's less citizens at sea. But certainly along the coast, there are some great projects, and Birdwatch do a number of those as well. So yeah, they're out there. Just getting more people involved, really.
And in terms of people in fishing fleets, for example, is there a role there? Do we get much feedback in terms of the data that they will be gathering for us?
Not really from the fishing industry, I don't think. They're too busy looking at all their gadgets in the wheelhouse, you know, so I don't think so. But, you know, like anything, you can't blanket a whole industry in one. If you have one or two interested fishers who record things, like we have with the Whale and Dolphin Group, you know, they can have amazing insight into stuff. So I think, you know, it's really a case of finding an individual who works in a field and empower them, really, and they're your champions then.
You mentioned the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group there, of course, and I'm sure most listeners would associate your voice particularly with cetaceans, these wonderful marine mammals. But of course, they and seabirds, they're intimately linked together. What affects one really affects the other. Do you find that in your research, that there are linkages there, and do the health of our seabird populations have any relevance, I suppose, to the health of our cetacean populations?
They do. If you think about it, you know, the sea is in a three dimension. So predators like birds, dolphins, whatever, you know, if you like sampling that three dimension, in effect for you. So seabirds tend to be the top few meters, or maybe 20 meters if you're a shearwater or gannet, but they can cover a huge kind of area, especially if they're coming back in the breeding season to the nest. So they're constrained where they can forage in three dimensions, distance from nest and three dimensions of the water, whereas dolphins are way more mobile and can go to greater depth. Whales can go down to 1,000 meters. So you can use predators, as if you like, as biological samplers. So if some of your predators, like some of your nesting seabirds, are doing very badly, it reflects changes in that part of the marine environment that they're sampling, you know, and vice versa. So you can get a real good insight, like you can on land, you know, with farmland birds or bogland birds or upland birds in the marine as well. So it's a very powerful tool, because it's quite expensive to take a research vessel and sample at sea.
Sure.
But predators sensors can do it for you. So, you know, Cork here are doing fantastic work with tagging and tracking of many seabirds, see where they go, see what depth they dive to, all that kind of work. And you integrate that, and it gives you a three-dimensional picture of your prey base and how that's affecting predators. But unfortunately, the long-term monitoring of our seabird populations is pitiful. We don't know the trends, and where there are changes, we don't know what's driving that. So again, data gaps, data gaps, data gaps. Empower our third levels, and let's start getting knowledge to inform effective conservation.
As noted earlier, a huge amount of work goes into the smooth running of a large event like this. Dr. Sandra Irwin of the President's Office at UCC, and a member of the scientific committee responsible for the conference, very kindly took some time out of her exceptionally busy day to have a chat.
Sandra, you look very busy.
Indeed, I am very busy, but it's wonderful to have so many delegates here to look after today.
I'm sure it's no easy feat organising something like this, but there's a real buzz about it, and everyone's been telling me how much they're enjoying it and how well organised it's been.
Well, I organise a lot of conferences, and these ornithology ones, they organise themselves. Everybody is so enthusiastic and so happy to get stuck in, and we have wonderful students that help us from the zoology department, so yeah, there's no shortage of help.
I'm certainly seeing a lot of people with name badges, a lot of people with bags. You must have the highest registration ever for an ornithological conference.
So we do, and it was hugely unexpected. So the largest registration we've ever had before was just over 150. Today we've gone over 240. I don't know how far we've gone, but we've gone over 240. But it's wonderful. It's fabulous to see the increasing interest.
It really is, and I think it's wonderful what UCC has managed to achieve here. It's the perfect setting for a conference like this, and it's great that people are getting a chance, especially after COVID, to meet each other. I've seen so many old faces I haven't seen in years, exchange the views and get this buzz off each other about the research and the work. It's wonderful.
It is, it's fabulous, and what's great about this conference is the mix of people that we have. So we do have students, we have academics, we have consultants, we have people from abroad. It's just, and we have so many members of the public who just come because they're interested in citizen science, they're interested in hearing what we do. It's fabulous.
And who makes the decision about who's actually featured in the conference?
So we have a scientific organising committee who review all the abstracts. So the event is chaired by John Quinn, so he chaired that session, and our other reviewers were the president of UCC, John O'Halloran, himself an ornithologist, and Pat Smitty, who was our keynote speaker last night, and Tom Kelly, who is a wonderful ornithologist who's been at UCC for a really long time, but he's now retired, but he does this.
That sounds like a lot of work.
The thing about work like this is that it's so interesting that it doesn't feel like work, you know, because all the work that comes into us in those abstracts, it's all about the new research that's been going on since the last time we had a conference, and it's all the current work that the students are doing. So it's so interesting to go through it. It's a privilege to get to do that.
Now, there's a bird that a lot of people in Ireland will have encountered in an unusual location, perhaps without noticing it. Well, at least people who remember the time before the euro became our official currency. But what about those born in the early noughties?
Hi, sorry to bother. Could I stop you for one second? You're a student here, yeah?
Yeah, I am.
What's your name?
Jennifer. I'm a second year student.
Hi, Jennifer. My name is Niall. I'm here talking about this bird conference that's going on here in UCC. It's all very exciting. You see the buzz around campus, I think, at the moment.
Yeah, there's loads of people about it, but very interesting.
So listen, I just want to do a quick experiment. I've got something I want to show you here. So I want to see if you recognise what this is. So
okay.
What's your reaction?
That is a coin.
Do you know what type of coin that is?
A 50 pence coin.
It's a 50 pence coin, yeah, probably a little bit before your time. And what do you see on that coin?
It is a bird.
Any idea what bird that is?
Is it a starling or a swallow?
Very good guesses. It does have long swept back wings like that. See, it's got a very long beak, sort of spread out tail. That bird's actually called a woodcock.
A woodcock.
And that's the bird that was featured for many years on the 50 pence piece in Ireland, pre-Euro, of course. And the reason I'm showing you that today is because we're just about to speak to a researcher who's going to tell us all about the woodcock in Ireland, doing lots of research into that species. But I'm particularly keen to talk about one that a lot of people in Ireland, at least of a certain generation, had in their pockets all the time without really realising what it was.
Yeah, I think if you ask a lecturer here, they probably know what that is, definitely, or anyone over the age of like 30 maybe. I'm definitely not 30, but no, that's mad. I never knew that was the main feature of a 50 pence coin back then, which is very cool, very interesting.
Yes, the bird that was featured on the old Irish 50 pence piece, and before that, in pre-decimal days, the farthing, was the woodcock. For many, this would have been the only place that they came across this highly secretive, superbly camouflaged creature of the forest floor. Though widespread in Ireland and found here year-round, the woodcock is a difficult bird to see.
A woodcock, I usually describe it as sort of a small chicken with a big long beak and a cocktail with this incredibly marbled plumage of black and russet and chestnut and cream, all different colours on this fantastic looking bird.
And of course, when you see an illustration of a bird like that in a field guide, it looks very distinctive. But when that's camouflaged in the leaf litter on a forest floor and it's dark, it's almost impossible to see. They blend in perfectly.
Yeah, and so predators, humans alike, have great issue spotting a woodcock.
Despite their secrecy, male woodcock have a very flamboyant courtship display called roding. James O'Neill is a PhD student at UCC, and he was attending the conference to co-present a paper entitled Modelling the Breeding Distribution and Abundance of a Cryptic Bird Species, the Eurasian Woodcock in Ireland.
The way to see a roding woodcock is you want to go out to a woodland site at sunset in the months of April, May, June, and there you will see, if woodcock are present, the males will start to fly these great big circuits across the trees, and they pass by maybe right for a few minutes, and they have this interesting double wing beat flight. It's a very slow flight, and they're calling constantly. They do this repeated call, which is like a series of grunts and then a little squeak, and they repeat this every few seconds. The purpose of roding really is to display to the females. The males are showing off to the females, but they're not roding over any kind of territory. It's kind of, the males all use the same patch, so it's almost like they're all competing with each other and showing off to the females and saying, look at me, but not at him.
So it's very macho behaviour, essentially.
Woodcock are of that nature in the springtime.
I was reading just very recently about woodcock, some research done into their tail feathers, and it turns out that this reflective white patch they have on the underside of their tail is actually the purest, brightest white of a feather of any bird. You've had woodcock in the hand. Is that something that you've noticed yourself?
Yeah, I wasn't surprised at all when I heard about that research, because the shining white on the underside of the woodcock's tail is absolutely beautiful, particularly in the moonlight, and it just shines. It's obviously not luminous, but it looks it. And the purpose of this bright white shining tail tips, only on the underside of the tail, not in the top side, is because the woodcock is such a fantastically camouflaged bird otherwise, that whenever it wants to communicate with other woodcock, it has to have some kind of a signal. And so if, say, there's a roding male flying over a female and the female wants to signal to him that she likes him, she'll flash her white tips to him and he'll see that, even in the dark, down in the forest floor, and he'll fly down to her.
I think it's a great one for pub quizzes, isn't it? What bird has the brightest feathers? And nobody would ever guess it would be the woodcock, the bird that's so cryptically plumaged, blends in with the leaves, you'd never think it.
There's a lot about the woodcock that you'd never think. It's a fascinating bird.
The loud, resonant, trumpeting call of the common crane. One of the purposes of conferences such as this one is to showcase ways in which avian developments have grabbed the headlines and caught the public imagination. A case in point, which we have discussed several times on Mooney Goes Wild, is the recent reappearance in the Irish Midlands of breeding common cranes for the first time in over 400 years. Since 2020, a lone pair of these enormous, elegant birds has nested on a cutaway bog under the watchful eye of Borden Amona. Co-presenter of a talk on this very topic, entitled First Breeding Success of Common Cranes in Ireland Since the 16th Century, is ecologist Sean Doyle.
Well, there's assumptions made as to how it disappeared. People suspect that it could have been hunting. But there could have been land use change involved in that as well. So it's kind of, look, they're the predominant kind of assumptions behind it, but that is what we believe caused it to maybe disappear from Ireland. With regard to its reoccurrence, it's likely a case, but again, unknown, that what we're experiencing is population overspill from the recolonisation of some of the countries in the UK.
Now, a lot of people across Ireland, when they hear the word crane, they think of a bird we more usually know as the grey heron. That name seems to have been transferred to that bird. So a lot of people mistake them. Now, the grey heron is an impressive bird. It's very tall, but the crane really lives it in second place, doesn't it? Can you describe it to us?
Yeah, I suppose the way I describe it to people who maybe haven't seen one before is it looks like it's nearly as tall as yourself when you're walking out along the bog. It's a large bird. It's kind of grey, white in colour largely, with a black neck, and then the adult birds will have a kind of a striking red marking on their head or on their forehead. I can see how maybe an inexperienced bird watcher might mistake a crane for a heron, but if you're experienced, it's a you're not going to mistake them for anything else, really, if you do see an adult crane.
And the heron, of course, is a bird you would tend to associate with wetlands, especially with large water bodies, seashore perhaps as well, lakes and streams. The crane traditionally, though, is very much a bird of the bogland, isn't it? It tends to be in open expanses. And those areas, I suppose, are fewer and further between in Ireland than they would have been historically. Is the restoration of the bogs by Bord na Mona, do you think that's playing a key role in the resurgence of this species?
Firstly, let's be hesitant to call it a resurgence. We have one breeding pair with two fledged chicks. It's on a Bord na Mona cutaway bog. They bred on a Bord na Mona cutaway bog, which is at the moment, it was abandoned and it's left to rehabilitate itself. So it's turned into kind of a mosaic of wetland habitats, and that is where the cranes are. So there's no doubt that this kind of habitat will support their kind of potential expansion, if there was to be one, that the wetland habitat that is being provided by rehabilitating the bogs will play a key role in that, if it were to happen. But it is too early to suggest that it's going to be critical. With peatland rehabilitation, there will be more habitat that should be suitable, but we can't say whether cranes are going to definitely expand into it or not, you know.
With the initial breeding attempts by this pair of cranes, we had our fingers crossed, we're very hopeful, but they were initially unsuccessful, which just shows that actually these birds do have their work cut out for them. What sort of threats do they face, and why would there be such high mortality of their chicks?
It is known that what we call sexually mature but still young birds, it takes them a while to learn how to be parents, in effect. Initially, they're not always successful. We don't know for sure what exactly happened to chicks that did hatch. It's kind of assumed that it may have been predation, but we don't know that for definite. As with any wild bird, and when there's only one pair, the chicks of that species will be incredibly vulnerable for a number of different reasons. Another maybe good example of what can happen in the early stages of crane mortality is the habitat that they were living on can be subject to like quick flooding. On a Wednesday, you could have the territory looks like it's completely safe and habitable, and on a Friday, it could be under 2 meters of water. So you could potentially have issues if the chicks were immobile or if it was still at egg stage.
You're quite right to say, of course, that it's early days yet. We can't really count this species as being recovered here in Ireland. There's a lot more work to be done. Having said that, at this conference, we've been hearing a lot of presentations about the declines in birds, the disappearance of species. It must be lovely to work on a species that at least is showing a positive trend, at least to begin with.
Look, yeah, it's very exciting to have a bird that hasn't bred in Ireland for hundreds of years, and you walk out onto the territory and nearly come across them by accident. Look, it's such an iconic bird, such a large bird, and when you hear it vocalising and see it interacting with its own young, and you know that, you know, very few other Irish people have seen this in Ireland for nearly half a millennium, nearly. So, yeah, look, it's very exciting, and hopefully the start of something that we can all look forward to these sounds returning to our wetlands.
Professor John Quinn is chair of the conference's scientific committee. The morning session of the presentation's over. I grabbed a quick word with him on the way to lunch.
John, sorry to catch you. I know that you're very busy at the moment, just taking a break, a lunch break, I think.
Yeah.
How's everything been going so far?
Everything's been going fantastically. They're all sitting on the edge of their seat listening to a fantastic range of talks. And I think one of the highlights for me has definitely been the talk about the common crane coming back to breed in Ireland for the first time in several hundred years. I was especially happy because it was one of our own undergraduates here from UCC who now works for Bord na Mona talking about his experience working with the common crane. So that's been absolutely fantastic.
There's a real buzz around the whole conference, a real energy. There's people I haven't seen in years, a great opportunity to share information. I think that's the amazing thing about these conferences. There's no substitute for meeting in person, sharing knowledge and ideas, questioning each other. It really is exciting.
That's always the case. And it's especially true this time because of COVID. COVID stopped us from communicating as often as we normally would do. After every talk, the applause is incredible. The questions are really just emphasize how engaged people are with these topics.
One of my favourite things about conferences like this and about interviewing people for the programme about this is when we ask a question and they say, I don't know, or that's very interesting. I must find that out. It really sparks more, the quest for knowledge, doesn't it?
It really does. You know, one thing that really stands out, how much we do know about our birds, but actually there's an awful lot more that we do not know. And of course, we're all very aware of the impact that things like agricultural intensification, land use change generally has had on birds. But what we don't know an awful lot about is what's going to happen in the future when climate change really kicks in. And there is this sense coming from this conference that, you know, we're quite nervous about the future. We're excited because we have some new species coming, but we're also very aware that some species have been lost. Over half of our bird species are of conservation concern. And that really is something that you sense in many of our talks here. The concern and an urgency to do something about it. And hopefully this conference will inspire lots of new research and lots more action on the ground as well.
Research is nothing without data. And getting that data sometimes involves a mammoth effort by large numbers of people. Long-term nationwide survey work is key here, involving thousands of eager and willing citizen scientist volunteers. Keen to highlight this, and to underline the benefits of long-term population studies, Leslie J. Lewis of Birdwatch Ireland was one of a number of experts who collectively gave a talk entitled Celebrating 30 Years of Bird Monitoring in Ireland.
Literally just finished, yeah. I had a really nice task today, actually, to celebrate 30 years of bird monitoring in Ireland and actually honour the people who've been involved over the years. So it's a little bit different to the other talks, talking about research. I was thanking people and highlighting all the achievements.
It is nice always to acknowledge the people who make this possible, because I think more so perhaps than in any other scientific field, ornithology is an area where the amateur at home can play a really significant role. I know that you've been involved in a lot of citizen science projects over the years. Can you tell us a bit more about that and the contribution that amateurs can have?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think IWEBS, what we call IWEBS and CBS, that's the Irish Wetland Bird Survey and CBS, massive examples of citizen science projects. They're celebrating the 30th and 25th anniversaries respectively. So they're long-running bird monitoring projects. So we have amazingly huge databases at this current time to do loads of analyses. And I think the thing I tried to highlight in the talk was that the centre of those two projects are the counters and the surveyors themselves, and the majority of those people are volunteers. Yeah, so I think it's quite incredible.
The cry of the banshee, or in reality, the screech of a barn owl. A creature that most Irish people are familiar with, not least from its appearance in the opening credits of The Late Late Show. These beautiful nocturnal hunters have been in decline in Ireland. Birdwatch Ireland's raptor conservation officer, John Lusby, was at the conference to explain why.
That's right, exactly. Now, just as you say, the barn owl, it is a species that has been in decline. It's what we call a red listed bird of conservation concern, which indicates that it is a bird that we are concerned about, that its population has declined over recent decades. The work that we're focusing on, or at least an element of it, is a barn owl diet, because obviously that's a hugely important part of a predator's lifestyle. It can affect its, you know, individual life histories, you know, the population dynamics. And it's a particularly interesting situation in Ireland. There has been a lot of work on barn owl diet carried out across its range throughout the world, but in Ireland's particularly interesting because we have two invasive small mammal species. Both are relatively recent arrivals to Ireland. The bankfowl arrived here from Germany back in the 1920s, the greater white-toothed shrew more recently, we discovered it for the first time in 2008. So with their arrival and their subsequent expansion as they expand their range throughout the country, that can have a significant impact on barn owls and on other predators, because it means that there's additional prey available for them that previously hasn't been available or that isn't available in other parts of the country, and that can have a big impact. And we're actually seeing that both in terms of the effect on changes to barn owl diet, but also changes in small mammal populations and in barn owl population dynamics.
When you're researching these mammals, of course, it's quite hard to find the mammals themselves. So analysing these pellets that the owls regurgitate, containing the fur and the bones of these small mammals, that's a very good way to actually track their spread, isn't it?
It is, and it's because it's a really quick and reliable. So barn owls regurgitate a pellet which has the remains of their prey within the pellet, and they're very much intact, so very easy to identify what prey species it is, what small mammal it is. So it's a very quick process to go to a barn owl site, look and see what it's been feeding on, and tell quite quickly whether there's greater white-toothed shrew present or a bankfowl present in that area. And through that, we've been able to track the range expansion of these small mammal species, and it's thrown up quite some surprises. Greater white-toothed shrew, I mentioned its recent arrival to Ireland, but it's spread very, very quickly. It actually occurs now throughout most of the country over a very short space of time. That was very much unexpected, but we're able to show that through looking at barn owl diet.
I know that a lot of your work, John, has centred around the impacts of rodenticides, or rat poisons, on predatory birds like the barn owl, also the kestrel and other species as well. Now, my understanding is that the vole and the shrew, they're not likely to consume rodenticides. So are we finding that the presence of these animals in Ireland is having a beneficial effect on our barn owl populations?
So it's a very good question. So we know that barn owls are susceptible to rodenticide exposure in Ireland. We know that, in fact, the majority of the wild population are affected by rodenticides. What we don't know quite yet, but it's something that we need to research further, is the link between the individual small mammal species. So the obvious ones, we know that brown rat and house mouse, they're obviously going to be coming into contact with rodenticides and therefore passing it on to predators, to other species. Greater white-toothed shrew, they're definitely not immune to being exposed to rodenticides. We know that they do enter bait stations, they do feed on bait. So while it might be that the risk of exposure is less compared to other species like brown rat, they still do pose a threat of rodenticide exposure.
Normally, having an invasive species coming into Ireland, it's not something that we want to see. But is there an upside in this case? Could these introduced species be the saviour of the barn owl?
I think there's both a positive and a negative with the introduction of the greater white-toothed shrew. We are seeing the response of barn owl populations. We're in fact seeing a slow population recovery, which is absolutely phenomenal for barn owls, something that I never thought I would witness. So we're seeing an increase in their range, an increase in their numbers and breeding densities in areas where greater white-toothed shrew have colonised, and that is fantastic to see. But with any invasive species arriving in a country that it's not native to, there is the potential for negative consequences as well, and we're actually seeing that on pygmy shrew, both in terms of the work that we're doing looking at barn owl diet. Also as well, there's been some really valuable research from small mammal ecologists looking at the competition between greater white-toothed shrew and pygmy shrew, and we're actually witnessing within our lifetimes the displacement of pygmy shrew over across large areas of the country, and that will seem to be continue as the greater white-toothed shrew continues to expand its range. So that is obviously a real cause for concern.
John's studies into a bird, the barn owl, have revealed that one of our native mammals, the pygmy shrew, is now at risk from an invasive alien cousin, ornithology contributing to mammology. There were a great many examples of this sort of multidisciplinary approach at the conference. As I was mingling with the attendees and reading the posters that shared details of their research, the one common theme was passion. That passion was plain to see when speaking to the dedicated volunteers, without whom long-term data gathering would be impossible. This is absolutely crucial when it comes to studying the changing aspects of Ireland's bird life over time, which was a recurring theme at the conference. Ireland punches well above its weight when it comes to waterbirds. Each year, huge numbers of ducks, geese, swans and waders migrate here to spend the winter on our lakes and other water bodies, where they join resident wetland species such as great crested grebe, moorhen and coot. But all is not well. Long-term studies have shown that winter waterbird numbers in Ireland are plummeting, something we would have no way of knowing without the efforts of the hundreds of volunteers who census bird populations at our wetlands. Áine Ní Chualamh is a volunteer zoologist with the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and she travelled to Cork to co-present a talk with NPWS ranger Sam Bailey with the title 40 Years of Changing Waterfowl Use of Loch Lean, Killarney National Park, County Kerry. I was curious to find out from Áine and Sam what trends they had noticed and to get their take on the increasing role that volunteers are playing in the collection of ornithological data.
Well, what we've seen have been dramatic drop in a number of species, particularly diving species, like tufted duck, coot and pochard, where we used to get like 600 to 800 tufted duck and 400 to 500 coot in the 70s and 80s. And in the mid-90s, there was a huge drop in those numbers. Pochard, we used to have 50 to 60. And again, in the mid-90s, they dropped enormously. Now we would get roughly 100 tufted duck in the winter period, and we would get no coot, like we might see an occasional coot, and the same for pochard. And that's in the winter period now, the IWEBS count period. In the summer season, the tufted duck and the coot used to breed on the lake, and we did nesting studies and found that about them. And again, a similar pattern of decline in the 70s and 80s and a big drop in the 90s. And sometimes in June now, we would not get any tufted duck. We would not see a coot during the summer months. We used to have great crested grebe, small numbers, 6 to 8 nesting in the reed beds in the 70s and 80s. Again, from the 90s, you just don't see little great crested grebe. We would see some occasionally in winter plumage during the winter, maybe one every few years, and that's it. The other end of the story then is that we have two species that usedn't to be seen on the lake at all. In the winter months, gadwall and little egret, and they're seen all the time in the last 5 to 8 years. And in the breeding season, we have gadwall, and we have recorded breeding in the last 3 or 4 years of gadwall. Little egret, we have them in the summer period as well, but we haven't recorded breeding of little egret as yet.
So from what you're saying, there have been some winners, but the vast majority of species seem to be losing out. Have you any idea what's driving these declines?
No, we haven't. We need to do detailed analysis of the data we have for the 44 years, and we also need, there is a lot more study, and there are some studies currently going on as well, including SAM ringing data and colour ringing birds. I'll hand over to Sam for that.
Yeah, so I mean, Arnia's done some amazing work. I mean, all of these counts are Arnia for over the last 40 years, and now it's our job to, as National Parks and Wildlife Service, to work out what is making these effects? Why are these numbers going down? And there's lots of potential contributing factors, disturbance, food availability, water levels, a whole range of things that we need to look into and do a lot more further study on.
And a large proportion of many of these species, the populations are migratory, so they're coming to Ireland for the winter, but they're breeding elsewhere. So it must be difficult to track down the causes. It could be on the breeding grounds, it could be on migration, there could be many factors.
Exactly, and some of these factors are happening nationally, so it's not just about the park. Some of these things are going on all over Ireland and Britain and other parts of Europe as well. But there are certain factors that potentially are very much about the national park. And as you say, coming from different areas, it could be to do with where they're breeding is a problem or where they're wintering is a problem, a bigger picture to look into. So we are looking to do some study work on trying to find out a bit more about where our ducks are coming from and going to through ringing. And that's something that we're looking to do a lot more of in the coming years. And hopefully we can get some indicators into what's happening there.
One of the key themes of this conference that I've been seeing is the power of citizen science, mobilising the general public to observe wildlife and, more importantly, to submit their observations to inform conservation scientists and ornithological research. How important do you think that is, and is it something that you would urge other people to do?
Absolutely, Niall. I think it's very, very important. And you don't have to be a scientist to do it. Anyone can make observations, and I would encourage people to do that, make observations and send them in. It's really important.
As Anya has said, you don't have to be a professional scientist to contribute to our understanding of the natural world. It's something that you can do from the comfort of your own home. Brian Burke is the coordinator of Birdwatch Ireland's annual Irish Garden Bird Survey, Ireland's longest-running wildlife citizen science project, to which thousands of households across the country eagerly contribute their sightings each winter.
Yeah, I often say that monitoring the common birds tells you a lot more, because if you think of some rare species, it might tell you, maybe about an individual breeding colony or breeding island or something very specific. But by monitoring your robins and blackbirds and song thrushes and dunnocks and blackcaps and stuff like that, it tells you about what's going on, all across the country, essentially.
So it's citizen science at its best. People can contribute in a very meaningful way to conservation science while enjoying watching the birds in their back gardens.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the easiest survey you can possibly do. But as I said, it's a mountain of data that it produces. It's quite reassuring for some species in that they've been very stable over the last 30 plus years. Some species, that we assumed maybe would always be fine, we're starting to see declines in recent years, and some increases in species that we never would have predicted. And it ties in nicely with other survey work that Birdwatch Ireland and other ornithology people in Ireland do, such as the Countryside Bird Survey, which is an NPWS project that Birdwatch Ireland run. So that runs during the breeding season, so that tells us about how the birds are doing during the summer, and the Garden Bird Survey then can fill in some of the gaps and tell us about how they're faring over the winter.
Yesterday evening there was a wonderful presentation by Pat Smiddy all about the birds of Cork, and in that he mentioned that he has seen and recorded significant declines in the greenfinch in particular. I know that's something that's been very much flagged up in the Irish Garden Bird Survey.
Yeah, they used to be in over 90% of gardens up until the early 2000s. And one of the real most common and most dominant species on feeders, people would see 8 or 9 quite easily each week throughout the survey. All of a sudden, this parasite that kind of existed in pigeons and in birds of prey, and it makes some of them sick, but didn't have a huge impact on them. It kind of jumped and adapted and evolved to affect finches, and in particular the greenfinch, and their numbers have fallen through the floor since, and every year more or less we're seeing a decline. So they've gone from over 90% of gardens now to fewer than half of gardens. And when people send in their results to me, they put a little note often saying what's gone up and what's gone down. And quite often people are saying now it's been 2, 3, 4 years since I've seen a greenfinch on my feeders.
Of course, this Trichomonas parasite has been causing big problems for greenfinches in particular. And I know we've had anecdotal evidence, many people reporting possible declines in their gardens. But having it on a firm scientific basis really shows that this is actually a real phenomenon. Do we have any idea what's causing it? And is there any light at the end of the tunnel for that species?
every year we kind of hope that we'll start to see the trend to kind of plateau a bit, and maybe they'll kind of hit some kind of stable level, but we're not seeing that yet, unfortunately. We did add a question to the Garden Bird Survey in recent years because we've got 2,000 people all across the country looking at their garden birds, so we take the chance to ask them extra questions if it can be scientifically useful. So we asked them to let us know if they're seeing sick birds, what species they're seeing, and when they're seeing them. So that was showing us that greenfinch are, even though they're quite rare in gardens now, they're still the species that people are seeing sick most often. Other finches too are being seen sick, chaffinch and goldfinch in particular. Doesn't seem to be affecting them to the same extent, thankfully. And actually one of the interesting things we've seen is an increase in linnets, which is another finch species, in urban gardens in particular. There's a lot of research that we plan to do in the coming years with the Garden Bird Survey data, and that's one of those things I really want to look into, is maybe the whole finch family, how different species are affected, and maybe if the decline of greenfinch has created an opportunity for the likes of linnet and maybe the likes of goldfinch as well.
There must be an absolute wealth of data in there over the last 30 years just waiting to be analysed by somebody.
Absolutely. There's so many different questions it could ask, and that long-term data set. And, we've got people who've been doing the survey for over 20 years, but we try to tell people start now and keep going, but it's absolutely amazing. And it's that thing of, if we ran the Garden Bird Survey every 5 years or every 10 years, we'd get a nice snapshot of what's going on. But it's having that year after year after year, and you can get to see the ups and downs, short-term, long-term. And from a scientific point of view, it's such a simple survey, but the data it provides is it's a goldmine.
It's very clear that ornithology is a discipline in which all of us can play a role. My abiding memory of the UCC conference is the sheer diversity of the attendees, professional and amateur, who came from all walks of life. It was a great success, as far as I'm concerned, full of state-of-the-art research and fascinating discussions. But what about the man who started it all almost 40 years ago, when he himself was a student at the university?
John O'Halloran, sorry to bother you. I know you're a very busy man, busy day for you. I just want to stop you quickly and just ask you, how has the conference gone?
Look, it's been fantastic. We started early this morning with some keynote address by David Cabot on barnacle geese. Long-term study, 60 years of data, incredible. And then we went through some exciting projects, from research to the first breeding of crane in habitat. So it's been an extraordinary mixture of really important monitoring, deep research questions, but also the beautiful, attractive blue tits and great tits and Birdwatch Ireland surveys. Fantastic.
When I was speaking to you earlier, you used the analogy of the starling murmuration, and that's something that I've been reflecting on and thinking about. It really is very apt, because it has seemed like a flock of like-minded individuals coming together, sharing knowledge and information, boosting each other, spurring each other on, and that's, I think, one of the big benefits of an in-person conference like this.
There's no question. I mean, as we say, everybody came as individuals today with their own individual projects, really excited about it, wanted to share with everybody else, and then suddenly we get into the room, that dynamic changes. A, because people get excited about people sharing their story, B, challenging that story and maybe some of the conclusions, and then raising further questions with taking people away for the next number of years to go away and research and ask new questions and collaborate with all people across the world.
And of course, we'll see some of the results of that hopefully at the 9th conference when that's held. Are you planning for that already?
I hope so, if we're still around in the 9th one. But look, I think the most important thing is that Birdwatch Ireland, together with ourselves and others, publish the abstracts in Irish Birds. Because this is really important. This is not just about bird watching. It's about studying birds, generating knowledge by bird watchers, so that we can actually make a difference in the world today with good citizen science contributing to that knowledge.
Scientific conferences play a crucial role in the dissemination of knowledge and provide vital opportunities for academics and researchers to publicise their work, receive and respond to constructive criticism, and gain fresh inspiration and enthusiasm for the pursuit of their chosen field. I'm certain that the 250 or so ornithologists and conservationists who gathered in Cork went away feeling as privileged as I did to have attended such a beneficial event. But that wasn't the only feeling I went away with. More research than ever before is being carried out into the behaviours and population dynamics of Ireland's bird life, and that ever-growing body of work is pointing towards one inescapable conclusion. Ireland's birds are in trouble, to a degree never seen before. The combined pressures of factors such as habitat destruction, agricultural intensification, climate change, pollution, disturbance, invasive alien species, and population fragmentation are pushing many ever closer to the brink of extinction. But there is still hope. And the first step towards a solution is gaining as full an understanding as possible of how our native bird species live their lives, why so many of them are declining, and which of their needs are not adequately being met. That for me, speaking as a conservationist, is the most important purpose of these Irish ornithological research conferences. Forewarned is forearmed. Without the scientific evidence to prove how our bird populations are faring, all we would have to go on is guesswork and hunches. The more we learn, and the more we share our research findings and techniques, the better equipped we'll be to spot worrying trends and to know best how to counter them before it's too late.